Hello, and welcome to the Mail Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. Alright, the numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top comic sales, the top 300, through Diamond to retailers for July 2011. July, of course, is when a lot of big news typically comes out because of the San Diego Comic-Con. Sometimes you get a lot of major releases. In this case, we're kind of in the middle of a major event over at Marvel with Fear Itself, DC with Flashpoint. Still a month or two leading up to the relaunch at DC. By the beginning of this month, people knew about the relaunch, so we may start to see some ramifications of that in the numbers for July, more likely for August. Now, Marvel, top part of the breakdown of the 300, top-selling 300 items, with 46.75% of the units, 49.3% of the dollars. Retail dollars, that puts them a little over $10 million at full retail price. Obviously, they don't get all of that because some of it goes to the retailers, some to Diamond, etc., etc. DC came in with 36.44% of the total units for the top 300 and 33.23% of the dollars for the top 300 units. Interesting, Marvel had 91 items, DC had 90 items, so really, that's a lot less for Marvel. It's more or less average for DC. Part of the disparity on the dollars percentage is just the average price at Marvel was a bit higher at $3.56 versus $3.15 for DC. What I found kind of interesting this time around was that no other publisher really came, you know, remotely close. The next one having being Image with 27 new items. 3.69% of the units, 3.38% of the dollars. And that's kind of the top of that middle pack of publishers. IDW not too far behind with 3.36% of the units, 3.83% of the dollars. So a little less by units, a little more by dollars. Again, that's a difference in average price.
Yeah, I mean, Image has a lot of $2.99 books, whereas IDW pretty much has the $3.99 books, right?
I think the only thing that knocked them below that for an average price of $3.85 is they had at least one, maybe two at a dollar.
Yeah, they which they both, Image and IDW, do, which I like. They have Image has the dollar samplers of, you know, classic number one issues and stuff. IDW calls them 100 penny press, and they're really good ways to sample some good series from the different publishers. You know, you can buy a number one issue or a jumping on point issue for a buck and try it out.
Well, and the Ben Arroyo titles over at Image.
Oh, that's true.
New titles are coming in at a dollar.
That's right. And that's actually a really good thing I like that Ben Arroyo does, that, you know, it's a brand new full length comic book that you can try out that first number one issue and see if you like it for a buck.
Yeah, and they tend to be a full 32 pages of story, not, you know, with the ads and stuff. I mean, just actual 32 pages of story. So it's a hell of a deal, and it really almost as much as possible removes that barrier to entry based on price. Now, what it does is it typically shifts that to the second issue of, okay, people bought it, but did they like it enough to now pay, you know, the $2.99 or $3.99 or $3.50 or whatever the monthly price turns out to be. You know, we've seen cases in the past, like when Radical first did some of their stuff, their first issues of that Hercules title and Caliber were a dollar, but then that second issue of each was either $2.99 or $3.99, and we saw kind of the dollar value of the sales for the two from month one to month two stay about the same, but of course, because of the difference in cover price, that really dropped the unit sales quite a bit.
I think that's happened with Dynamite, too, when they've had some of those $1 kickoff issues. They sell just a ton of those dollar issues. And, you know, a lot of that, I always wonder, you know, is how much of it is actual sales versus just what retailers are willing to risk, because, you know, those dollar issues are generally ordered, and then the second issue is ordered before the fans have a chance to buy the dollar issue and make any kind of a judgment one way or another.
Well, that's part of why the change between the sales of the third and fourth issue tend to be pretty revealing. That's where you tend to see the correction, because by the time retailers are ordering that fourth issue, that first one has gotten into their store, has sold, and they can actually order based on how their customers are reacting to that property. You know, typically when we start to see a turnaround on a title, it's at about that point or an issue or two later, depending if it's something that comes out of the gate strong or is a little bit more of a sleeper hit and takes either a couple of weeks or an issue or two. You look at both Walking Dead and Invincible. Both of them had a downward trend for the first half dozen issues or so. Then it starts to go up. And part of that is, again, the customers, the readers actually have to see the material before saying, wow, I love it. And it just needs a little time to build up some sales momentum. Now, we've got a couple other publishers around that, you know, 1 to 4% range. We've got Dynamite, Dark Horse, Aspen, and Boom. And then from there, it drops to the sub-percent of the breakdown kind of a thing, you know, range or whatever. And we've got, you know, a couple of publishers in that area, too. And typically, you know, we're seeing the same kind of publishers in each of these kind of three groups. Marvel and DC, you know, doing a majority of the business. Usually about 80%, 85% in this case, I believe, by units, it is 83.19%. So the remaining 16.81%, again, split across everybody else, with the premier publishers taking, let's see, how much are they taking? My mouse is not cooperating with me at the moment. There we go. Taking 9.48% between Image, IDW, and Dark Horse. So, you know, you add that to the 83.19% of Marvel and DC, and the premier publishers are taking 92.67% of the sales for the top 300. Add in the other usual big dogs of Dynamite and Boom, and you've accounted for over 96.5%, 96.51%. So really, it's one of those things where success begets success. The bigger publishers, because they're more recognized, because they're better known, because people think, wow, they've got good stuff that sells, I'll go check those things out. A lot of these other publishers are just having, in some cases, hard times getting into various stores. And a couple of these publishers on the list only have a single item. Now, in some cases, they may only be producing a single item. Other cases, they're producing a lot more, but only one of them is getting into the top 300.
Yeah, and then, you know, you look at something like Archie that has three items on here. I think Archie still does a decent amount of newsstand sales that aren't reflected here.
They do predominantly newsstand sales, last I looked.
So it's not completely reflective of where their sales are coming from. You know, so I think they do. Have you looked at what any of the do they still, since they're on the newsstand, do they have to put those circulation things in their comics?
They do have to put the statement of ownership in there. And I looked at those last year. I probably have those sitting around over on my bookcase over there somewhere. And as I recall, they were doing, you know, double-digit thousands. In the case of one of the digests, they might have even been doing over 100,000. On an issue basis, but I'm going from memory. I could be wildly off base on that, but like in this case, at rank 294, we've got Archie 623 selling 3,669 estimated units in the direct market. In the mass market, that's, you know, a drop in the bucket. That would be maybe easily 10% of their sales, if not a lot less than that. But I would have to, again, go dig up the statement of ownership and stuff. I talked to somebody over at Archie at Comic-Con, but I have not had a chance to follow up with them. And basically what I talked to them about is if I could get copies of their statement of ownership information, going back really as far as they've got, to highlight this exact issue. They're a publisher that is very non-standard in this respect, in terms of the majority of their sales are outside of the comic book stores at, you know, convenience stores, grocery stores, bookstores, newsstands, those kinds of places.
Yeah, and they're just they're a lot more popular than would be led to believe, you know, if you're just looking at comic shops, because, you know, a lot of comic shops don't have them at all, or they're, you know, a copy or two off on some kid rack somewhere. But, you know, they sell a lot of comics each month.
Well, it's funny because there are a couple of other cases in the past where there have been items that would sell well over 100,000 copies, not hit the diamond list at all sometimes, or do so very modestly. Another example of that, and this might be close to 10 years ago, was the Left Behind series that Wildstorm did. And it's a religious-based storyline, what happens after the rapture or whatever. And it sold just gangbusters at church bookstores and places of that nature, whereas in the comic stores, yeah, it was there, but nobody really paid attention to it. And it was interesting. I forget who wrote it, but the artists were Aaron Lopresti, who's been doing Wonder Woman. He's been doing the Justice League Generation Lost stuff. He's going to be doing Justice League International for the relaunch of DC. And then either Jeff or Phil Moy, I forget which one, who had done Legionnaires, and who's going to be doing the upcoming Star Trek Legion crossover. So, I mean, they had some name talent on the art and stuff. But again, because of the nature of the material, that was something that just sold gangbusters outside of the direct market, and really outside of the mass market even, and that was a very kind of a specialty case thing. But I don't want anyone to see those sorts of things and then say, well, then the numbers we're talking about aren't reflective of reality or whatever. I mean, they are. There are just some exception cases. You know, Archie is certainly one of them. On the trade side, you see a lot more with the mass market properties of, you know, Buffy, now Walking Dead, or certain things that are going to do well in the mass market. And other things that do, you know, either well or just okay in the direct market don't even necessarily show up in the top 750 on BookScan at the end of the year. You know, a lot of the mid-list superhero titles are that way. So I still feel very strongly that the numbers we're looking at are indicative of what's kind of shaping the decisions at Marvel, DC, and these other publishers as to what direction they go in and stuff. So, you know, at the top of the list, we've got...
I guess, just on that final point on that is, I guess my point is, I think Archie is going after a very different market than the typical comic shop market. I think that they have a lot of the younger kids, you know, buying that stuff. And what would be curious to me is, how do you tap into that, you know, to get those, as those kids, as they get older, onto the other comics? Because there's,
I question if it's the kids or the parents of younger kids buying them for their kids.
Right, but the kids are still reading them, right? I mean, if the kid's just like, I don't want to read that, and just throw it out.
Just like your sons are going to read stuff that you have available for them or hand to them, that doesn't mean they're going to necessarily go seek that same material out, much less other material. I mean, that's the point I've got there, is I don't know that we've got a younger generation that are just so gangbusters about either Archie or comics to then launch into the superhero titles or something like that.
And I guess the thing is, you know, maybe they're not going to want to read superhero titles, but would there be a more, you know, some other genre that is more of a logical outgrowth from Archie, you know?
Well, I mean, you look at TV shows, and it's surprising that there really are no comics that are either legal dramas, medical dramas, the basic PI type stuff that seems to be the hallmark of half the primetime dramas.
Yeah, you know, you got Castle and The Mentalist and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And lots of the cable channels now have lots of shows in that genre, too.
You know, like, I mean,
Burn Notice and all kinds of things.
There's the standing joke of, you know, take two people of random, you know, occupations, toss them together, they're detectives. You know, that kind of a thing is a staple of television shows, yet I would be hard-pressed at the moment to name any ongoing title anywhere in comics, really, that has that kind of, you know, non-costumed hero detective or investigator, of whether they're officially a detective or not. You know, and again, half the TV lineup, it feels like at times, has that.
Yeah.
So I certainly think there's a strong case that other genres beyond superheroes could certainly find an audience in comics. I don't think that's, again, to say that superheroes are the problem in why comics aren't selling well, which a lot of people seem to jump directly to, of, well, if it wasn't for superheroes, comics would sell better. It's like, well, no, frankly, if it wasn't for superheroes, comics would be gone for the most part as a business, you know, because that's what's at the top of the list. That is what is continuing to sell. The fact it seems to have squeezed out a lot of other genres is unfortunate, but is a reflection of how the market evolved through natural market forces. So, I'm hoping with DC introducing a couple of other genres and stuff, their war title, their, you know, trying to think what other genres they're really hitting. They're doing more on the supernatural and stuff, and we'll see how that goes. It'll be interesting to again, watch the relaunch.
Yeah, they have a Western.
Yeah, the Western's the other one I was thinking. So, a Western, a war genre. It's great. We got all these other genres back. Now, so, top of the list this time around, we've got Amazing Spider-Man 666. It did about 135,564 units. That is a jump of about 78,618 units. This not only was the start of Spider Island, this is the one that had the Godzilla gimmick of the retailer's specific covers. If they ordered, I believe, 500 copies or more.
Yeah, it was 500.
Yeah, did all right. I got a question, how much of this was just it's the start of Spider Island versus how much of this was the multiple covers? Don't know.
Well, I mean, there were at least 100 stores. I think I saw there were like 100 variant covers or maybe even a little more than 100 variant covers, you know, at 500 copies per.
So that'd be 50,000.
You know, that's a plus. It's the start off of Spider Island. So, I mean, it's, you know, they got a decent bump off that. And,
yeah.
You know, the question is, you know, how often can Marvel or anybody else go back to the well with that particular gimmick, you know, before it goes down, you know, and it's like, it's a nice promotional thing. I'm curious as to how many of these stores are going to have copies of, you know, Spider-Man, you know, saves, you know, XXX comics, you know, on their rack. You know, they got to sell 500 copies of that. So, you know, a lot of those Godzilla stores, they still got the copies of Godzilla sitting around.
I've got to think most retailers know that going in, that aside from some of the largest retailers out there, the likelihood of most retailers selling anywhere remotely close to the 500 copies, even of Amazing Spider-Man, pretty low these days.
Yeah, I'm guessing that they're going into it with their eyes open, and it's a promotional thing that they will have in their store for years. My point is that once a store does that and they've got, you know, an issue of Spider-Man with their store name on it that they're going to have for years, how much are they going to want to have an issue of Captain America sitting in their store for years also, you know?
Yeah, it's a hard stunt to duplicate. The fact Marvel even tried this close after the Godzilla one is, I find, a little surprising. And I don't know that the Spider Island story, which is so regionally limited in story scope to really the Manhattan area, if that was really the right choice for this or not. Now, next item on the list is Captain America, actually. It's the new number one. It did 96,923 units. Only one item cracked the 100,000 mark this time around. Now, it's interesting that this is the sixth volume of Captain America by my count, with five of the six having started in the last 15 years, the longest running of which, two of them lasted until issue 50. So, I mean, based on that, safe money is on, you know, little over 4 years from now, sometime within the next 5 years, really, we're probably going to see another Captain America number one again. And I'm getting a little tired of the renumbering gimmicks. I mean, I get why they do them. I'm not going to say it's not successful. Note the ranking on this. Note the sales on this. Obviously, it's working. While it works, they're going to keep doing it. It's a business that makes sense.
Did you hook, like, I guess Captain America and Bucky number 620, it's a follow-on from the previous volume of Captain America 619, right?
Correct.
What did that issue sell? So how did Captain America and Bucky do compared to the older Captain America versus, you know, and you know, now they've spun off a new Captain America?
Let me pull up last month's spreadsheet because that's going to be the easiest way to go find that out, because when they change the names, I'm doing the matching on the names right now. 619 of Captain America did 44,796 estimated units.
Okay, so this was 51 for Captain America and Bucky. So, you know, it went up from that. And then the new cap is 96, almost 97,000. So, you know, success on their part.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like I said, if it works, they're going to keep doing it. And it's working. Why would they not do it at this point? Jeez. I think they're going to go back to that well too many times. The fact that, you know, every third year on average, we're getting a new Captain America number one, that's going to get old after a while. If nothing else, it's going to get confusing when people are looking at back issues, if anyone still does that, saying, well, I need issue, you know, 13. Well, of which series? You know? Now, the next two slots are kind of interesting. At rank 3, we've got Fear Itself number 4 with 93,432 units. And at rank 4, we've got Flashpoint number 3 with 86,000 and about 4 units. These are both down a little from the previous issue. Fear Itself about 6.1%, Flashpoint about 7%. I don't think there's anything to be alarmed about there, because part of that is factoring in reorders for both, which happened this month and stuff. Because if you look down near the bottom of the list, there's, again, reorder activity on Flashpoint number 2. I believe that's at rank 258, and I'm pretty sure in here somewhere. Yeah, Fear Itself, it's number 3, had some reorder activity at 289. So part of that is again, just the numbers of the previous issue continuing to inflate. And no doubt these will, too. We'll get some reorder going forward. What's interesting, though, is the sales of the secondary titles. Now, we talked about this a little last month. We'll no doubt talk about it a little next month, too. But if we filter the list on Marvel just down to those that start with kind of Fear Itself, you know, the top one of those is Uncanny X-Force, or Fear Itself, Uncanny X-Force number 1, 39,604 units. The lowest of the bunch is Fear Itself, Fearsome 4 number 2, 17,764 units. Now, what we talked about last week on the Weekly Comics Spotlight when we were talking about the Spider-Island first part, or actually the Spider-Island Cloak and Dagger and stuff, was how, you know, like in your case, you were getting that, but you're not getting most of the various Spider-Island stuff. You're not getting a lot of these other Fear Itself things. You're not in the minority. You're actually in the majority here. Most people are, you know, not getting these secondary titles. On average, they're selling about 26-27% of the Fear Itself issue for the month. So the fact that Fear Itself and Flashpoint are still strongly within the top five, if it hadn't been for the gimmick on Amazing Spider-Man and the Captain America number one gimmick, they probably would have been the top two titles. To me, that says people are not burnt out on events. They're burnt out on oversaturation.
And Marvel is noticing that those ancillary series are not selling. As we mentioned briefly on the last Weekly Comic Spotlight, so Fear Itself's now going to have an issue 7.1, 7.2, and 7.3. So that's, you know, marketing trying to do an end run around, well, if you won't buy Fear Itself Captain America wrap up, you know, maybe you'll buy Fear Itself 7.1. And we'll see. We'll see how that works for them. You know, if 7.1, 7.2, and 7.3 are selling, you know, are not selling 50% or less of what Fear Itself 7 sells, that was a successful gimmick on their part, and expect to see a lot more of it.
Oh, yeah, and as we talked about in that Weekly Comic Spotlight episode a week back, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they get to the point where they just decide to take one of these 35-part stories, do it as a 35-part limited series, and just dump 7 a week or something crazy. You know, number them so you know the order to read them in, and just try it that way.
Oh, I mean, I hope they don't. They usually don't number things so you know what order to read them in.
It's again, I'm still confused on some of this, because on some of these Fear Itself, you know, Youth in Revolt, I think it was the Thunderbolts issue, and I thought there was an X-Men one. They're all fighting Juggernaut in different cities across the country at seemingly the same time. It's very confusing.
Juggernaut gets around.
Apparently.
Can't stop the Juggernaut.
Now, over in DC again, we're seeing very similar things with Flashpoint, where the top-selling one, in this case, it was Flashpoint Batman Knight of Vengeance number 2, doing 40,759 estimated units. That is about 47.39% of the sales of Flashpoint number 3, going all the way down to Flashpoint the Outsider, doing 22,944, which obviously is little over 25%. What was interesting is Booster Gold number 46 only sold about 29.3% of the sales of Flashpoint, and it's the only ongoing that really ties into Flashpoint, with sales of 28,396 units. That's actually up about almost 8.5% from the previous issue, but still, the way that title had been selling on a regular basis around, say, the 16, 17,000 mark lately, it went up quite a bit, actually, but compared to when we saw a doubling and tripling of sales back on Civil War, when we saw a doubling, tripling, or quadrupling of sales when they did the promotional Power Ring gimmick with Darkest Night, this could have done a lot better. You know, again, particularly as the only ongoing title to kind of hook into it. So, you know, if, again, you're wondering why Booster Gold's not getting a series after the relaunch, that's kind of why. I think, again, this goes towards the oversaturation of secondary titles. It's not really, I think, a reflection of people saying, okay, we've had enough with events. I do think Marvel and DC in particular, should back off on these events. I think they need to give their new round of titles a little bit of time to kind of come together and work as individual titles. And if they do a universe-wide crossover or whatever in this new universe within the first year, I think that's going to be a very questionable decision and one I would recommend against.
Yeah, it's the same thing with smaller publishers. You know, it's like they have all these titles, like the Atlas relaunch. You know, there's an ad in there that, you know, they relaunch Phoenix, Grim Ghost, and Wolf the Barbarian. And then there's an ad in some of the recent ones that they're going to do some kind of a crossover event. And I'm not convinced that that's the greatest idea. You know, it's likely that, you know, people will say, oh, instead of going, oh, I'm only buying one of these titles, I think I'll buy all three, is they'll just say, you know, I don't want to buy three, so I'm not going to buy any. You had a similar reaction with the Warlord of Mars books over at Dynamite. You know, it's like you were fine reading Warlord of Mars, then they like cranked out Warlord of Mars, Deja, Thoris, and Fall of Barsoom, and you said, oh, well, I don't need to get any Warlord of Mars books. One was fine, and two is too many, almost, you know?
Well, at that point, it was the three was where it got in there, because I got the second one they did. Part of it, though, was with Dynamite in particular, was fear of a repeat of what they did with Green Hornet. They went from one title to about five in really rapid succession, and now they're back down to just the single title, I believe.
Dynamite likes the oversaturation, you know.
Well, for a licensed property, I see the business logic behind it. You've got that license for X amount of calendar time. Crank out as much as you can during that time to see if it's going to work for you or not. The downside is, you know, for any particular property like Warlord of Mars, like Green Hornet or whatever, I think the people who are going to read any one of those titles is pretty much the same audience. Now, I think with some properties, you've got a bit more ability to expand it out. I mean, I'm really shocked they didn't use that kind of a publishing approach to Star Trek, because I think there are people that are fans of the original Kirk and Company that may not be of Next Generation or vice versa, and Enterprise and Deep Space Nine and Voyager. So you've got five pretty distinct branches of the franchise that you could have legitimately had going concurrently without people thinking you were kind of oversaturating necessarily. Now, there would have been some that said, oh, five Star Trek titles, it's too much, and maybe it would be. But I think it's different with five titles with five different casts of characters versus, you know, the Green Hornet stuff where it's Green Hornet and Kato of some flavor and variation in each of the different titles. You know, and it.
Well, even though they have a device where it's like, you know, these ones are in the past and these ones are in the present and these are these other ones, it's not as clear and distinct.
Yeah.
Because people aren't as familiar with it.
It muddies the water pretty quick. And I think Marvel is doing a really bad job of oversaturating things with the number of X-Men titles they've got, the number of Hulk titles they've got, and DC, at least with all their plethora of Batman/Gotham City based and related titles, for the most part, aside from Batman itself, that character characters showing up in too many titles, they tend to be pretty distinct both before and after the relaunch. But I think they would do better with really each title having a clear, distinct identity and reason for existing.
Dynamite has been grabbing up new pulp licenses lately. So they just, it'll be a couple of weeks ago as you listen to this, but they announced they got like licenses to the Spider and also the Shadow. You know, they already have the Phantom. So these are all kind of pulpy. I mean, these are taking aside like Doc Savage and the Avenger that, best of my knowledge, DC still has licenses running to that they were using for their first wave, and it remains to be seen whether they'll let those licenses lapse or not, you know, with the relaunch, because I don't think they sold that well. I would be surprised if they let the licenses lapse. Would Dynamite swoop in and pick up those licenses to add to their growing kind of pulp stable that they've got?
I would think if Dynamite had the financial flexibility to do that, they would and they should, frankly. Therefore, from a DC perspective, would it make sense to hang on to the license, maybe not actively use it, just to prevent the other people from doing it? I don't think that's how DC would operate, but I could see that question at least coming up in some companies. If you can't go for the win, at least go for the block. But again, look at how DC handled The Boys and facilitated getting that over to Dynamite. So, you know, it may be that while DC couldn't make the first wave stuff work out for them, those properties transitioning over to Dynamite could be really a win for pretty much everybody, including DC.
My fear, and Dynamite now with me, and it sounds like with you a little bit and with other people, I mean, they have a obstacle to overcome, and that is, because of their tendency to overexpand franchises when they get their hands on them, I would be reluctant to pick up a Shadow or a Spider title from them. Because, you know, I'll pick up a title and then the next thing I know, 2 months later, they're putting out three books.
Yeah, I definitely think, certainly for me, that is a concern. I mean, even as recently as July, because I'm talking to the solicitations when I say they're down to one. They had Green Hornet, Kevin Smith's Kato, Kato Origins, Green Hornet, Aftermath. They might have had a few that didn't make the top 300 there. They've got Boys and the Boys Butcher Baker Candlestick Maker series. They've got Warlord of Mars, Warlord of Mars Fall of Barsoom. I don't see the other Deja Thoris one on there, though. They're already taking the Kirby Genesis stuff, spinning that out to another title. We've got Queen Sonya and Red Sonya, Revenge of the Gods. I see why they do this with licensed properties, but there comes a point where if somebody wants to dip their toe into the water and get a title, it gets really hard to do that without feeling like, well, you know, geez, I'm not going to get the whole story about the Boys if I don't get this miniseries, or am I really going to be able to follow everything going on with Kirby Genesis if I don't get this, you know, Captain Victory series or whatever it is.
Right. I mean, I was happy buying the Boys. And when they started, you know, okay, the Boys and the Boys Highland Laddie, and I'm getting it. And like the Boys and the Boys Butcher Baker, and I just dropped it. I dropped both of them. You know, it's now, like I would have happily been going along buying just one Boys title, you know, for as long as they put it out.
I can practically guarantee you, Bob, that right now somebody is listening to this thinking, but you don't have to get the other titles. And you know what? They're right, but I also think to a degree they're wrong. In so much as like with the Green Hornet Kato stuff, they're different continuities. You don't need to get it to buy into the storyline to figure out what's going on. With something like The Boys, I don't think that's true. I think you lose out on the bigger picture story by not getting some of these side stories. And well, it goes towards accessibility of comics these days.
On The Boys in particular, what would have kept me on it was if Derek Robertson would have stayed with the main Boys series. But no, Derek Robertson went over to do the miniseries, right?
Yeah.
And that was what got me to drop it.
It almost comes across as a bait and switch. Yeah,
right. If I could have just ignored the miniseries. I mean, and to me, Derek Robertson, I mean, he's one of the, you know, founders of the franchise. I want to read the one that he's doing, but I'm not going to read just the mini, and it's just me, you know. So,
well, it comes down to what kind of a reputation do these publishers acquire over time. And I think Dynamite's doing some great stuff. I'm enjoying a lot of their titles, but I was enjoying Project Superpowers. It just kind of faded away, with the implication there would be more, but nothing announced, as far as I know, either way. You know, again, the Green Hornet stuff, they expand the franchise, then they collapse the franchise. You know, with the Bionic Man stuff, are they going to expand the franchise and then collapse the franchise? What are they going to do with this stuff? They've, as a reader, I'm getting a little, I don't want to say gun-shy, but, you know, perplexed. I liked what they were doing with Star Trek. They still got the license, but they're not really using it. They got the license for Stargate. Completely squandered that.
Now, how is their Star Trek license Star Trek? I mean, because I thought IDW had the Star Trek license.
I'm sorry, you're right. I'm sorry. I'm getting them confused. IDW is the other one that does some of these, that expands and contracts the franchise. My mistake on that one. That was IDW.
But, you know, they do a lot of TV stuff. I mean, they did some Terminator books. They have Total Recall series coming out.
Total Recall number 3 is actually on this at rank 300 with 3,531 units.
I mean,
Warehouse
they did
13's coming out. So yeah.
They did an Expendables series, you know, that went for like 4 issues. You know, they do a lot of licensed stuff. And on one hand, I think it's good because they're recognizable properties to people who don't normally read comics, if you're somehow able to get those seen by, you know, people who are familiar with the movies or TV shows.
Well,
and
I mean,
somehow drive those people to buying and seeing these comic books.
Look at this list of titles for Dynamite this month. Top selling item is Boys. Okay, that's a original property, not so much to them, but at least original to comics. It started at DC, of course. Kirby Genesis, which is kind of an original property, kind of a licensed property, but it's still original to comics. You then got Boys, Butcher Baker, Candlestick Maker. But then everything else below that is really a licensed property of some sort. Vampirella, I believe, originated in comics. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Yeah, it did in comics and magazines.
But Warlord of Mars, Green Hornet, Queen Sonya, the Sherlock Holmes, obviously, the Robert Jordan Wheel of Time, Total Recall. I mean, Dynamite is very heavy in the licensed property camp, and there's nothing wrong with that. I like seeing properties I like that are otherwise, you know, dormant and not getting used, you know, revitalized in the comic format. Again, I'm looking forward to the Bionic Man stuff. But I think that publishers need to balance that with doing original properties and showing that they basically have some creativity as a company and not just, yeah, we're taking somebody else's great idea, cranking out a story or 5 every month and going with that.
Oh, and then another thing that kind of gets you, and sorry for harping on Dynamite here, but it is a general principle that you lose story momentum when you can't keep an issue, when keep a series coming out on a regular basis. I don't know if you have access to the publishing history of like The Last Phantom, but that one is a series that I at least feel like has had some big delays in coming out. I was really enjoying that for the first few issues, and then it seems like they were coming out more and more infrequently. I seem to have more and more issues piling up on my, I've ordered them, but they have not shipped until I finally just stopped ordering them.
Well, Warlord of Mars, number 8, shipped 8 weeks late. Boys actually shipped 3 weeks early for issue 56, and Butcher Baker Candlestick Maker a week early. Queen Sonya, number 18, 17 weeks late. Kevin Smith's Kato, number 11, 22 weeks late. Robert Jordan, Wheel of Time, number 11 there, 14 weeks late. Green Hornet Aftermath, number 4, 2 weeks early. Total Recall, number 3, 2 weeks early. But the number of weeks between issues for like that Sherlock Holmes year 1, number 5, that was 7 weeks late, 8 weeks. 8 weeks between issues for that Robert Jordan Wheel of Time, number 11 we talked about there a second ago, and 8 weeks between issues of that Green Hornet Aftermath and Total Recall, 9 weeks actually for that Total Recall number 3. So I think Dynamite, while they're doing good stuff, needs to be working on getting the stuff running on time. Now, in fairness, they had a couple that came out exactly when they were supposed to. That Terminator RoboCop Kill Human number 1 came out on time. Vampirella Scarlet Legion number 3 came out on time. Warlord of Mars Fall of Barsoom number 1 came out on time. Kirby Genesis number 2 came out on time. But when you've got a couple of things that are months late, and particularly when you've got like 2 months between issues, and I don't think those are bi-monthly titles, that kills the momentum. And that's not unique to Dynamite by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, no, there's a lot of publishers that equally applies to, if you want to look at it. But, you know, again, it doesn't affect people necessarily who choose to read comic stories in trade paperback format. You know, it's like
It does, because it delays the trade paperback. And if you're just reading a trade paperback, you're right, it doesn't affect them at all. If you're reading the series in trade paperback, and now instead of 6 months between trades, it's a year, year and a half.
Yeah, you might forget, you know, a lot of these, I don't know that they've had enough collective issues to worry about a second trade coming out. But, you know, your point is valid if you're looking at a series of trades coming out. But, you know, for reading issues when they just come out very erratically, it opens the door, you know. So like, well, you know, I will get some other things, and maybe I'll like those other things better, because, you know, I'm expecting once a month to be plunking down my money to buy Title X, and if Title X does not come out, well, I'll buy something else, and maybe I'll like something else better, and then I don't need to buy Title X anymore.
Well, if you look at Dynamite's breakdown of dollars between how much they're getting from the comics that month in July here and how much through trades, it's about a 89% to 11% split, with the majority of it coming through comics. So while there's some that are closer to a 50-50 split, in a lot of cases we're seeing, again, the 80-20 rule kind of, or 90-10 rule almost, applying, where the majority of money is coming in on the comic side. So that's really what's driving content and driving the readership. And if you can't get those comics out on time, that's really shooting yourself in the foot. It kills the not only the story momentum, but the sales momentum. So again, not unique to Dynamite by any stretch of the imagination, but it certainly, you know, exemplifies it in many respects this month. We also had the Daredevil number 1 come out this month. It hit at rank 6 with 64,864 estimated units. It's actually not too bad, but again, we're at the point where by the time we drop out of the top 5, we're below 65,000 units. You know, it used to be that we would have a number of titles up near or above the 100,000 mark. But, you know, it was back when we had an Avenger title or two, not 4 or 5. You know, it goes, I think, towards the point of marketing gimmicks can get titles up there for a bit, but sustaining sales, 50,000-60,000 these days are strong, sustaining sales levels. And that, frankly, I find that a little worrisome. You know, we had Green Lantern there between Flashpoint and Daredevil at rank 5 there with 74,519 units, which is really strong, and why we're not likely to see many radical changes in that area. We've got War of the Green Lanterns Aftermath number 1 coming in at 61,164 units. Again, kind of making me question if that's considered kind of a side miniseries to that War of the Green Lantern incident that was happening in the different titles. I mean, it's that Aftermath sold better than Green Lantern Core and Emerald Warriors, actually by a wide margin, but not as good as Green Lantern. So do they just have too many Green Lantern titles out, maybe? I don't know,
but Green Lantern does seem to be shoring up the top of DC's list, I mean, along with Batman. But, I mean, three of the 5 books in the top 10 for DC are Green Lantern titles, you know, so that they're certainly popular with the readers or buyers.
Well, they've been investing a lot of time and energy into that franchise over the last couple of years, from the Sinestro Corps War through, you know, Darkest Night, Brightest Day and stuff, or Blackest Night. I always do that. They've really been expanding that franchise, energizing that franchise, and doing a lot with it. So the fact that it's up near the top, not a big surprise. You know, now can they do that with other franchises? Don't know. It's interesting that the Batman titles we have near the top of the list for DC are Batman The Dark Knight. Really, those are the top two Batman titles, with issues 3 and 4 having come out in July. Batman and Robin, and then Batman. And then we get a little ways down to where below 40,000 with the two issues of Detective. We get further down for, you know, the Red Robin, the Birds of Prey, and some of those other titles. And it's interesting how Flashpoint is, you know, while in some cases has some lackluster sales, is still selling better than a lot of ongoing DC titles. Most of them are selling better than Teen Titans. All of them sold better than Batgirl, Superboy, Legion of Superheroes, Gotham City Sirens, Adventure Comics, Supergirl, Secret Six, Titans, Zatanna, Power Girl. It's actually interesting. Zatanna beat out Power Girl this time around. And I guess last time too. Although it was pretty close last time, only about 500 units. Now it's about 1,000 units. It's going to be very interesting to see where the numbers land with the relaunch and stuff. Looking at the DC retroactive titles is kind of interesting. Those fell between ranks 145 and 163, with sales between 14,340 down to 11,462 units, with the order being Batman, then Green Lantern, then Justice League, then Superman, then Flash, then Wonder Woman.
Now, interesting, you know, though, that I mean, those are $4.99 titles, so I mean, they're selling not as many copies. They're making, you know, more money than some of the ones that sell a little higher.
You have not read these, correct?
I have not read these.
I have found these pretty interesting. I've read the 70s and the 80s. I'm trying to think if the 90s have come out yet. I've read some of the 80s. I haven't read all of them. I haven't read the Green Lantern, Justice League, Superman one. What I have noticed for some of these, in a couple of cases, they pick some really good stuff. In a few others, they pick the first part of a storyline. The Green Lantern one was the start of the road trip storyline that we did on the back issue spotlight a while back.
Did they at least point you to the trade paperback that you could buy if you want to?
That would have been a really smart move now, wouldn't it?
I'm assuming that they didn't.
They did not. And there were one or two others that were, I think it was the Superman one, might have been the Flash, I think it was the Superman one that did the Superman Flash race that was two issues of DC Comics Presents, and they did one of the two. I forget if it was the first or the second part. But there were a couple where it's like, it's almost like they picked a random issue. It didn't seem like it was a springboard onto some, or it was a springboard into a story, but not into what should I go get next. It didn't even tell me necessarily which issue they were reprinting. If I were DC, I would have used the retroactive stuff to spotlight key points in the DC history, not necessarily by decade, but where key things changed. I would have done a Flash thing that reprinted the Flash of Two Worlds, introducing the concept of the multiverse. I would have done the Superman issue where they get rid of Kryptonite for a while. I would have done the Wonder Woman one where she gets rid of her powers, goes into the white jumpsuit or whatever. Things that show that over time the DC universe has always been changing, and use that to kind of alleviate concerns as to the radical changes we may be about to be in store for at the end of the month.
It's actually an actual interesting point that, you know, highlighting those kind of change points would have even given a common theme across them.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of tied them together. But I guess they didn't do that. So no. I just skipped it. I figured, you know, I don't have enough time to read the stuff that I'm already getting, and they're $5 a piece, and there's a lot of them.
I'm enjoying them, but they are highly skippable.
So these are the 70s ones that are on this list, right? And there's a lot of them. There were fewer 80s and 90s ones, I'm guessing?
I think there was six of each, and I think it was same properties. I think it was Batman, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, Superman, Flash, and Justice League for all three rounds.
That is a lot of lot of retroactivity.
But I think they could have positioned things better to really highlight, you know, how things have changed over the years, whereas and significantly changed. You know, when I talked to John Rudin, Bob Wayne at San Diego Comic-Con about this, Bob Wayne was equating this to when, you know, Batman got the yellow oval behind the Bat's logo on his costume, or when, you know, Clark Kent stopped working from the Daily Star and was at the Daily Planet, you know, was kind of how it was. And that wasn't even really a job change for him, just a renaming of the place he worked at, kind of. I don't know how it panned out in the continuity when the comics were coming out, but to equate what we're getting now, or what we're about to get with the relaunch, as the equivalent of a cosmetic costume change or a job change for a character, I think is a little disingenuous, because we're about to see a lot of characters, a lot of their history, potentially rolled back and redone.
Well, he was probably going for is that those are the things that are acknowledged as the break point from the Golden Age to the Silver Age.
True,
for
true.
Those characters.
But to, and you know, I don't disagree with his point so much as to set the scene of what we're going to get is going to be minor cosmetic changes. We're just going to get the collars and really not much else will change on these characters. That's not the impression I'm getting from the way they're soliciting it, the way they're pitching it, as there was no backstory of heroes prior to 5 years ago in that universe. That in and of itself implies a fundamental shift. Now, should people be panicking over that? Certainly not. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. But I think as well as DC has been positioning this relaunch, and they've been doing a good job, there are a couple of opportunities they had to do a little bit better. Have you seen the video commercials they're going to air?
I watched the long one. I was unimpressed.
I watched both and I was unimpressed. It did not scream out to me, hey, these are comics, versus, wow, these are really cheesy animations. I mean, they were motion comic type stuff.
It didn't draw me in to any kind of, here's some interesting story or character and you should check it out. It was more like, here's a bunch of pictures with this loud music playing behind it, you know, that, okay, and, you know, I see a bunch of pictures of superheroes. There was nothing there that was compelling.
I mean, to me, what they should have done is conveyed a couple of things in those commercials. These are comics. Comics are cool. You should read them. And I don't know that they really conveyed any of that. But, you know, we'll see how it works. Maybe somehow this will connect with people who watch these commercials and we'll see a new influx of readers. But gut feeling, I wasn't the least bit excited. You don't sound the least bit excited by those things. And we're the choir they would have been preaching to. You know what I mean? So the fact is, in this month of July's sales, the average for DC Comics was 25,232. They can do better than that.
Well, I have said on this show and a regular one a number of times, I've said, I hope they go out and get a quote-unquote real marketing company to do marketing for it. Those commercials look like they were done in-house by the DC guys. Those look like what would be put together by the DC marketing department. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I was afraid that they would come up with. I'm still crossing my fingers, hoping against hope, that there will be some kind of advertising that will resonate with a quote-unquote normal person, you know, but that was not it.
Yeah, and again, maybe it'll click with non-comic readers. I would be shocked if it did, though. Hopefully, like you said, they've got more in store, and they've got, you know, a couple of weeks. But I really think the way they position this in the end of August, early September time frame, particularly that last couple of days of August and the first week or so of September, is going to be a really big deal for how well this relaunch works for them in terms of, can they get new readers in?
Now, I'm looking at this Iron Age comic because you kind of drew my eye down to the DC Retroactive and Iron Age. This is another thing that I skipped. That's $4.99? Is that like really long or something?
Hang on, let me pull those up. I've actually been reading that, and I've actually been really enjoying that. The basic premise there is somebody that Stark has had, Tony Stark has had some minor dealings with in the past or whatever, blames him for everything, essentially goes and tries to destroy the universe using Dr. Doom's time machine. Tony jumps in and winds up back in time with demolished armor, and when he was in the current then-current timeline, drunk. So he doesn't really have a whole lot of resources he could draw on. So let's see, Iron Age, which rank is that? The 144?
144, yeah.
Yeah, 14,426 units. I frankly think it should have sold a little better than that, but I mean, they're not really pushing that. It's falling eighth fiddle or whatever behind Fear Itself, Spider Island, whichever, you know, other, you know, incidents and events and crap they're pushing these days.
I'm thinking, I don't remember my exact process for deciding not to get it, but seeing that it's $4.99 might have been a contributing factor to me deciding not to get it.
I'm pretty sure it had more than the standard number of pages. Let me check the solicitation real quick.
No, and at $4.99, I would expect it to have more than the standard number of pages, but still, it's one of these things where it's like, you know. And that was, again, that was part of my, you know, like when I saw the DC retroactive. I mean, when they solicited those things, they didn't specify what was being reprinted. They didn't give much of any kind of feeling of what was going to be in those. And they were $4.99. And I'm like, well, I'm 99. Since I have pretty much every DC comic from the 70s forward, I'm going to have the reprint that's in there. So do I want to pay $4.99 for those? My answer was no.
No, and I can understand that. This Iron Age was 48 pages, though, and I think they gave a decent solicitation for it. Whereas you're right, with the retroactive stuff, it's we're going to reprint something and have something else in there. And it's like, really? That's all the information you've got? I will say that they have been capturing the look and feel of the 70s era and the 80s era pretty well in the new unprevisely printed published stories. Yeah, Iron Age, I think, was just kind of a stealth solicitation that really, I think, could have done better if they'd actually pushed it some.
Mm-hmm.
Captain America Corps, loved the first issue. About 44.20% of the sales went away after that. It dropped quite a bit with that second issue. We're seeing a lot of those kinds of drops these days, and that's not a good sign. There are a few where I think the drops are, frankly, somewhat deserved. Rank 188 with the Zombies Christmas Carol lost 22.9% of its sales on the third issue.
Oh, my. Zombie Christmas Carol. I skipped that one.
I should have.
I got tired of Marvel Zombies after about the third one.
This isn't even Marvel Zombies.
I know.
So
it's,
much. Yeah, it's, yeah.
It's just like zombies in general chasing Ebenezer Scrooge around or something.
Pretty much. I would say you can't go wrong with that, but they most certainly did.
That's funny.
Now, there are a couple of cases where I think actually a 45% drop in sales is not something to panic about, and is totally understandable. And 282 was Samurai's Blood number 2. Now, that first issue was the dollar. That second issue is the $2.99. And again, that's part of why we're seeing what looks like a really steep drop-off in terms of units, and is. However, if you look at the dollars spent, it doesn't look quite so bad. So I think a lot of retailers are, unsurprisingly, budgeting their cash in terms of cash value, not number of units.
And maybe they're thinking, well, if the dollar issue sells really well and people are, you know, banging on the door for more of this comic, I can do a reorder or get a second printing or whatever, you know. And that's the thing. It's like, if you buy, let's say, 50 copies of a dollar comic, or let's say 20 copies of a dollar comic, you know, your outlay of money is, you know, somewhere north, you know, around, let's say, approximately, it's probably a little more for most shops, but it's, you know, around $10, $12, you know. But then if you're going to buy those same 20 copies of a $3 comic, you know, it's more of an outlay. And until you know that that's going to sell, you know, are you going to make that outlay?
Yeah. Well, and again, the whole point of these dollar first issues is for both readers and retailers to try the stuff out. And I think publishers do this with the full expectation that, you know, sales are going to be less on the next issue. Quite a bit less because of the difference in cover price. But the truth of the matter is, it is unbelievably rare for the sales of a second issue to exceed the sales of a first issue. You know, so really that first issue is setting the high watermark in a lot of cases for comics. You know, with Chew, Walking Dead, and I'd be hard-pressed to name any other exception off the top of my head, the majority of cases the sales just go down from there. You know, the evergreens of the Superman, Batman, X-Men, the properties that have been around since the Earth cooled or whatever, different matter because they were started in an era when comics just sold better. But these days, you know, new titles, whatever you get for that first issue, if you can work your way back up to that, you've done well.
The one that really is a little more puzzling to me is if you look at 256 and 257, is you got Marksman number one, which had the dollar first issue, selling just a hair over 5,000 units. And then you've got The Vault, also from Image, you know, not through Ben Arroyo Studios, but, you know, its first issue was 350, and it's selling 49.82. So, I mean, they're both essentially selling the same number of units, around 5,000 units, and one was a dollar and one was 350, which is kind of indicating to me that the dollar price was not particularly causing shops to order more copies of Marksman.
I would disagree with that. I think they did order more copies than they would have at a $299 or $350 cover price. Now, does that mean they would have ordered, you know, more than The Vault or whatever? I mean, The Vault could have done, you know, maybe another few thousand units if it had been priced at a dollar. So comparing the prices and the sales on this for frankly, fairly different properties, I think is a questionable move. In other words, yeah, there's not that much difference in sales between those two. While there is a huge difference in price, but I do think Marksman would have sold a lot less at the higher price and Vault potentially a little bit more on the first issue at a lower price.
Yeah, well,
it comes down to, I mean, Sam Sakaar has a bit more of a track record as a writer and stuff than I think David Baxter and Dave Elliott. You know, it also comes down to how effectively the Vault was promoted versus Marksman and stuff.
Yeah.
There's so many different factors here that I don't think that you can look at these two and then say doing it at the dollar price for first issue is a bad move. You know, is it always going to pan out? Not necessarily, but I think it's a smart move to do, particularly in this kind of a marketplace. Sales are usually going down across the board, and if you can remove the barrier of entry on that first issue, you should. Because I don't think either Marksman or The Vault is going to have any other issue that sells as well as these first issues.
Yeah, well, I mean, that does not bode well for either of them.
Less well for Marksman.
Right.
Because it may get that 40, 50% drop on that second issue, whereas The Vault is unlikely to get that.
Right.
But to me, that's a reflection of presumably the strength of the properties versus the introductory pricing. But certainly the pricing is a factor too, no question about that. It all comes down to what strategy the publishers have in terms of how they want to get their stuff out to market and where they want to position it. This time around, over half the list, 155 items, were at $299 price point. A little over a third with 106 items at the $399 price point. Had only about 16 items at the $350 price point. Almost a dozen with 11 items at the $499 price point. Half dozen issues at the $1. And then one item each for $250, $295, $325, $599, $699, and $799. So it's definitely tilted much back in favor these days of the $299 price point. I see that as a good sign, and frankly a bit surprising because, I mean, really the pushback and the rollback of the price from, you know, $399 to $299, a lot of that, again, goes to DC, and it had to be a very expensive and a controversial move inside of DC to do that. We're not really seeing sales go up as a result of it, making it all the harder for them to justify, no doubt. But certainly I think the fact that the retailers and readers were able to push back successfully to some degree on the price hike to $399, that's pretty much unprecedented.
But, you know, the top-selling Marvel books are $3.99, so not pushing back that hard.
half the list is 299.
Right.
So, I mean, the fact that there has been pushback at all in a lot of cases, I mean, people complained about the 299 price point. It didn't roll back to a cheaper price. So, is that saying that the 399 is going the way of the Dodo? No, certainly not. But it's not the de facto price for a new comic. That, I think, is the big win. Now, whether we'll be able to say that come January, don't know. That's pretty much when DC's commitment to holding the line at 299, I think, is set to expire, if you will. Whether they renew it or go to 399, we'll see. So, anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
That does it for me.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you're in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. If you're a resident of some other space-time continuum, please limit any actions you may take to that alternate reality. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. Diamond Order Index only goes to 2 decimal places, and therefore there's a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. For months in which no issue of Batman or Detective shipped, Batman: The Battle for the Cowl was used instead. The title used as the key title is irrelevant. If you do not understand why or do not believe this, please consider taking a refresher course on basic algebra. Math is fun, but only if you understand it. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Sell-through information is not currently available, and we limit our reporting to the available information. If, however, you enjoy fiction, please listen to this preview spotlight for our recommendations of upcoming comic books. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications that at least one retailer may have excessive amounts of empty shelf space with dust that needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold to Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month in question. The list of the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to the retailers for the month in question. More than 300 graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of the top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 100, 50, 25, or as few as 10 items on the list. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as we know, has not been invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic book, graphic novel, or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 300 graphic novels and collected edition lists are included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. For some strange reason, Diamond doesn't report on sales to competing distributors. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any item sold outside of Diamond's comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. We limit this report to the available data. If more data becomes available, we'd be happy to include it. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for. No amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is inapplicable in the alternate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there. I have neither the time nor the interest in engaging in pointless debates in this hypothetical reality. There are no guarantees of accuracy, reliability, completeness, or timeliness of any of the information given in the course of this discussion. We are human, and sometimes we make mistakes. We appreciate your understanding in this area. Any statements that may contain projections or other predictions about future events should be viewed as opinions that are subject to change as new information becomes available. Actual events may unfold in unexpected ways. As Doc Brown once said, the future is what you make of it. If any statements are contradicted or contested, the participants of the discussion may disavow any knowledge of those statements.